Thanks. Okay, so without further ado, let me start and, So I should start with acknowledgements because I'm sure that I won't get to the, even probably to the mid of my talk, and therefore then 100 slides later you will find an acknowledgement, and it will be kind of a torture for you as I cycle through 100 slides to find acknowledgements. So the kind of, I don't know how much we will progress today, but the work that I will be presenting is done by very talented people from the group, mostly Shimon, who is a great experimentalist. He was in my lab, now he's in Israel, and Adrian, who did both theory and experiment, Sanchari, more kind of late experiments, if I have time, and I'm sure I won't have time to discuss viral evolution, but that was done in collaboration, kind of microfluidics part with Dave Weitz, and some aspects of kind of virology was done in collaboration with these people, but I'm not sure that I will get to that, and that brings me immediately to the outline. As kind of, as Michael said, kind of I've been here many times, and I know how the system works, and basically the lectures and the presentations should be as pedagogical as possible, and I will try to follow the advice and the lead, and I'll try to be more pedagogical, and therefore there will be quite a bit of introduction and quite a bit of discussion of relatively old results, like roughly order of magnitude 10 years old, and as we progress and if time permits, I will come to closer to more recent results, and some of them unpublished and some of them are not even complete or fully understood, but they are very exciting, and if time permits, we will talk about that. And so first I'll start from theory, which motivated the switch from kind of purely theoretical mode in my lab to theory slash experiment, kind of you will see why. And kind of this will be the bulk of the talk. I will discuss how to understand fitness landscapes from biophysical molecular perspective, where possible, sometimes of course not possible, but surprisingly and amazingly sometimes really possible, and you get some really, really kind of clear insights from that. And basically the idea is to kind of to build some projections of fitness into some biophysical properties of proteins, and I will go through kind of for each of them I have a story for stability, activity, abundance, and protein-protein interactions. And that follows, unlikely that I will have time to discuss that, but kind of that helps us to understand such important things as antibiotic resistance, kind of to be very predictive in terms of which alleles arise to escape antibiotics, and highly unlikely that I will get there, but again, these type of ideas help us to understand how viruses evolve, and there is a considerable effort, multi-lab effort, in which we participate actively under auspices of DARPA to understand and predict viral evolution. And again, I mean, probably I won't have time for that, but the story here and the message here that sometimes it is possible to even predict kind of the path of antibody escape of viruses, again using some ideas from biophysics. And kind of the driving, the really, really the global idea in evolution is fitness landscape. And many people kind of think about evolution in terms of fitness landscape, and indeed it's a highly useful and colorful metaphor. And the reason why it is metaphor, because we all understand what is plotted on the vertical axis, and this is some form of better or worse defined fitness. You can kind of, again, there is a huge debate what fitness is, but at least for some simple organisms, like again, viruses, bacteria, there are very well kind of formulated and definitions of fitness. So this is something that we can sort of define practically and mathematically and understand. But what is on the horizontal axis, of course, is entirely unclear, because obviously we cannot map the whole genotypic space into fitness, because this space is extremely multidimensional. You have enormous number of genotypes, and you cannot map any genotype to fitness on the one hand. On the other hand, of course, what often kind of viewed as fitness landscape is that we kind of, you map past alleles to phenotype or to fitness. So, for example, if you think about viral evolution like flu or whatever, you kind of look at previous strains which dominated, and then for them you can know or sort of even sometimes predict fitness. But then, of course, the limitation of this view is that any de novo mutation does not belong to this fitness landscape. So if virus or bacteria or whatever finds some creative way to escape some stressor and develops another mutation, another allele which helps it, then it's not part of this fitness landscape, and therefore this type of thinking about fitness landscapes are not very kind of help us to predict. And so kind of the questions that I was trying kind of will be the dominant theme of the whole talk today is how to map the fitness landscape onto some meaningful coordinates so that it will become predictive, it will be kind of will give kind of will be conducive to some understanding, and things like obviously kind of central questions in evolution like epistasis, so whether the effect of mutation depend how and how does the effect of mutation depends on the background, on previous mutations. And another very important topic, which again I will address here, is pleiotropy, so that each mutation affects several traits, and then you have to think how they talk to each other so that moves on this fitness landscape would be not along a single axis, but somehow on diagonal, and therefore this type of moves can be understood. And kind of now, again, as a matter of introduction, of course, people think about that, have been thinking about that for more than a century now, and there are very established approaches, which are known as, generally speaking, as pop genetics, where essentially kind of there is a certain assumptions about mutations, and most importantly, certain assumptions about fitness effects of mutations, and then there are really quite beautiful mathematical tools that allow us to determine the fate of mutation in the population. Again, it's a very lively area, as you all know, very developing, but kind of the intermediate between the mutation and sort of some phenomenological aspect of variation at the genetic level and the phenotype is completely kind of a black box. So kind of what usually population genetics theories use are some assumption which is called DFE, distribution of fitness effects, for better or worse. I mean, they are somehow kind of, and there is also kind of an inverse problem that when you see some phenotype arising, kind of can you predict distribution, can you determine distribution of fitness effect from some phenotypic properties that you observe? And this is all kind of very decent, of course, and very interesting set of questions and very interesting set of tools. Yes?
On your previous slide,
yep.
Some of the caveats that you introduced about
right.
the applicability
yes.
of this idea, are they resolved by thinking about time scales, that is, separation in of time scales?
In pop genetics or in sort of biophysics, because these are different things?
Well, I'm thinking genetics.
Well, I think...
you're introducing very broad time scales in the
right.
next...
Right, absolutely, yeah.
You can address these,
right.
but then the things you want to address are actually
right.
occurring at many different times.
Right, no, that's absolutely right, and that's probably the key question, because kind of if I can reformulate your question, the way probably is that whether this distribution of fitness effects evolves itself, which is actually the question about time scales, whether you have an intermediate time scale at which DFE sort of evolves. The answer to this question is yes and no, and there are phenomenological sort of theories which try to address it this way or another, but again, kind of, at least from my perspective, they're extremely phenomenological and they introduce new sort of assumptions and very hard to tell what comes from assumptions, what comes from actual. But the key problem here, actually, I think kind of you definitely kind of hit the nail is that the DFE itself is not a static property, and the typical kind of pop genetics approach is assume DFE as a static property, and the alternative approach is to fill this gap by some molecular events, kind of trying to understand that what actually, because indeed there is a multitude of scales, and jumping from kind of microscopic scale to population scale is a huge leap, and so what we are trying, and what kind of I will try to present today is attempts to fill this kind of to fill this mismatch between time scales by some molecular, cellular, and cell biology details, which allow to get rid of this kind of major caveat. And the major caveat is, as I said, that DFE itself is a fixed property. So that basically DFE itself will be not an assumption, but a consequence of some physics and biophysics. And that's kind of, if it's a take-home message, that is it. And then you can sort of stop following, etc. But the point is that the attempts of these approaches, again, for better or worse, is that to replace the assumption of sort of static fixed DFE by sort of rules of physics and statistical mechanics when possible, so that DFE itself is the outcome of the model or a calculation or experiment. So that is the whole point. And then, of course, as your system evolves, what remains static is sort of laws of statistical mechanics. And DFE itself kind of changes as your system evolves. And then, of course, you can think about that again in terms of population genetics, but on more local timescales. Kind of, you can really bin timescales in on which you think about the problems. And that's the key difference between a sort of standard pop genetics and the approaches that we and others, of course, not only we, but there are many people who try to do this, are trying to advocate and develop.
And how does your approach differ from population genetics in terms of addressing the ecology and the environmental components of fitness? Because it seems that a given molecular change can be very different depending on the environments.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true, and that's the whole point. Again, I probably won't have time, because I have a story just exactly to answer this question, and the story is about evolution of antibiotic resistance. Because basically the point is that kind of the classic, the standard way is, again, fitness landscape at some concentration of antibiotic. Now you change the environment, you change the antibiotic concentration, for example, or temperature. In this type of approach, ideally, and again, I have the story which sort of supports that, you can, from molecular properties, you can predict fitness in a range of concentration of antibiotics or temperature. So it's predictive in a sense. And then from that, you can predict which alleles will come up first in response to such and such concentration of antibiotic. Because kind of the ones that are fit at low temperature become less fit at high temperature. And these molecular tools allow to predict which ones become more, which ones become less fit in different environmental conditions. And therefore, if your bacteria evolves antibiotic resistance at 37, the order of mutations will be different than when it happens at 30. And again, if I have time, I will argue that's what these kind of tools allow you to sort of predict. So let me give a couple of examples where this type of approaches work in a sort of ad hoc meta. So there is one kind of one way to fill this gap of scales is to develop again sort of multi-scale models, and these are kind of the model that again we and others practice. And basically the idea is that instead of moving, jumping right from here to here, is kind of the model, a typical model of that sort would have cells which have kind of quote unquote real genomes, it's namely a DNA sequence. DNA sequence encodes for some set of proteins, and again, they can be very simplified models of proteins, they can be much more advanced models of proteins. But the point is that we sort of now, kind of with all these 20 years of, say, protein folding, etc. studies, we more or less know how to go from this stage to this stage using kind of the rules of statistical mechanics. So if you have a sequence, you can fold proteins in this sequence, you sort of set up certain rules of their interaction, certain rules of their expression in this model cell, and then kind of essentially there are random mutations, and then there is a map between all these kind of things that happen at this level to fitness to the rate at which these model cells divide. And of course, this assumption that I will argue it many times today is a huge leap of faith for which you actually need experiments to make sure that your assumptions are not crazy. So basically, up to here, it's more or less kosher. So kind of you use more or less rigorous laws of statistical mechanics to come from sequence to some model structures and their interactions. From here to here, it's also okay. But from here to here, you make an assumption of how everything that is going on at this level is related to something that is going on at this level. So there are, and again, I absolutely don't want to talk about this more, but there are many papers which use this type of modeling to address this type of questions, and if you are interested, these are references. So let me give you an example of kind of a little bit more in a little bit more detail how this type of approach at the level of theory works. And one of the assumptions that you can think of, which sounds very simple and in some cases even is good, and in some cases I will show from experiment is really terrible, is that fitness is proportional to the number of folded proteins in the cell. So basically the idea is that if proteins fail to fold for the reasons of rules of protein folding, that's very bad for the cell because they cannot perform their function. So if you have more functional proteins, and functional protein is a folded protein, you have kind of better fitness, and that links kind of fitness to protein folding, and the number of folded proteins is dictated by rules of protein folding. In this case, I will be kind of don't need to go into really detail, but this is the very, again, standard and in many cases correct view of how proteins fold thermodynamically, that this is a two-state system. You have two states. One is fully unfolded, floppy, and one is functional. And there is a parameter which is determined by protein sequence. And this is the difference in free energy of folded, or kind of between folded and unfolded state. Then, of course, the usual Boltzmann relation for two-state system. And it gives you kind of fitness as a function, as a sequence-dependent function, because delta G depends on sequence. And this P folded, the proportion of folded depends on delta G. And fitness depends on the how many of them are folded. And that gives you the simplest, this formula gives you the simplest fitness landscape. It's simply mapping this formula into as a function of delta G. Now, when mutation comes, it either stabilizes or destabilizes the protein. So each mutation is a step on this landscape to the right or to the left. And so kind of this is what happens, delta G fold. We know the statistics of this mutations, the delta G's from experiment because people measured them many thousand times. There are kind of in the literature, this is a very developed fields, field of experimental biophysics, and you can collect statistics from the literature, which we did 7 years ago, 8 years ago, and it's a Gaussian distribution. So if you consider this as a random step, this distribution of steps is Gaussian, with bias to the right, obviously, because average mutation destabilizes the protein. Kind of 80% of mutations destabilize the protein randomly. If you mutate randomly, about 20% stabilize. So with chance 20% you move to the left, with chance 80% you move to the right. And
this 80-20% will depend on the protein and the size.
On the protein size, yes, it will depend. Actually, there was a work by Tofik and Serrano where they sort of studied that. And if you look at the core mutation, the distribution is a little shifted, kind of according to the analysis versus surface. So it would slightly shift with surface to volume ratio because these distributions are somewhat different. That's absolutely true. And so essentially kind of you can translate now the effect of mutation into selection coefficient, how fitness changes. And what you get is really kind of looks fairly trivial, but in fact you get something really kind of interesting because what even this very simple view gives you the idea that the landscape is highly epistatic because the selection coefficient depends not only on the effect of mutation on stability, but also on stability itself, which is absolutely clear from this curve, because if you mutate here, then the selection coefficient is the slope, so how much fitness changes. So here the slope is almost non-existent, so if you mutate your protein with high stability, it almost doesn't care. But if you mutate a protein with marginal stability, it will care a lot because fitness will drop enormously. And so this is really very simple. And then kind of you can work out, this is published several times, the more detailed pop, kind of you can link it to pop genetics, whether in monoclonal regime, polyclonal regime. So basically the drill is that you now plug this S into north kind of more or less standard pop genetics theory, and you get kind of the for example, the distribution of stabilities at equilibrium. And what you get is that sort of there are two forces that balance each other in this business. And one force, of course, is genetic drift, which pushes you to the right because most mutations are destabilizing. And then selection, which pushes you to the left because as you start to lose fitness, selection turns in and you get the balance. And the balance between mutation selection balance, so basically the sort of equilibrium distribution of stabilities establishes as a result of mutation selection balance. And kind of, if you again take kind of the numbers right, etc., it's at about minus 0.4 kcal, which explains what people call marginal stability of proteins. But of course, there is nothing magic about that. It is simply kind of the value of stability at which selection and drift balance each other. Kind of you can go a little further than that, and you can establish a little bit more insight into that. For example, an interesting prediction from this fusion of, say, simple protein folding with pop genetics is that the stability of proteins depend on a number of environmental factors, kind of, and one of them is the population size. So the prediction number one is that if you have a greater population size, then kind of typically proteins in the organisms which have greater population size will be more stable.
This is size of the population of proteins or size of the
Population of organisms.
And why is there a connection?
The reason for this connection is the following. Kind of the strength of selection here depends on the population size. And if your population size is great, it pushes you further to the left, because even kind of at large population size, even a weak slope will be felt as a significant loss of fitness, because what enters into pop genetics is not S, but N multiplied by S. So the strength of this force to the left depends on the population size. If you have a greater population size, then the balance between drift and selection is established at NS of order 1. That's how this number is obtained. So when NS is of order 1, this is roughly kind of this 4 kcal for kind of bacterial. But if you increase N, you move to the left.
Can I ask
you,
what is an example of a protein where having more of it just where the model works well?
I will show in the experimental part. I will exactly tell you that kind of that that's exactly the question. So I'll address this question.
I still don't understand why delta G depends upon population. That the equation you have there is not something about selection; it's about delta G.
No. The slope is proportional to delta G here. If you change delta G, you move right here. This is the kind of this is the effect of mutation, and this is kind of the selection coefficient itself depends on mutation on delta G. So kind of again, this is the slope of this curve depends on delta G, and when slope is 1 over n, you reach the equilibrium, and as delta G becomes greater and negative, you move here.
I think I understand that, but if you go forward a slide, please. Yeah, here.
Right here.
So now you have the expected value of delta G.
This is average over proteome in a, okay. Yeah.
But you're saying I'm still not seeing why that is a function of population size. The expected value of delta G is.
It's average. It's not necessarily expected. There are very long tails in the distribution. It's average.
Okay.
It's average. But we can talk about that more.
It's the value that you evolve to in selection for equilibrium.
Yeah.
It's the equilibrium.
Yeah, this is the equilibrium value. That does not mean that every protein will have this value of delta G. It's absolutely not true. But the average over the distribution, so in the proteome, you will end up with a distribution because it will fix a different stochastic. But the average of the distribution is dependent on population size. And then there is, yes?
I have a related question.
Yep.
So the equilibrium also depends on the mutation bias,
right? Right here.
So that's a measure of the directional bias.
Yeah, this is a measure of directional bias. I mean, there are two parts of that. One is the average destabilizing step. So how much in average a mutation destabilizes the protein. Now that's more or less fixed. It's roughly 1 kcal per mole. And then how much you kind of what is the mutation rate. This is the mutation rate. So the prediction is that with higher mutation rate, you will get less stable proteins. And that comes from polyclonal, actually, calculation. In monoclonal, the mutation rate will completely fall off, obviously. So, but if you do a full polyclonal model, you will get it. And
And how you establish this correlation between average platelet G and population size?
You mean in experiment?
Well, not at all. How, where does it come from? From your calculation? I mean, you
from the calculation,
delta
yeah.
G, you calculate delta G for how?
No, no. What I calculate is kind of basically what I do. It's very simple. I simply apply the relation S multiplied by N is of order one, because that's the relation at which mutation and selection kind of balance each other. Drift and selection balance each other. If you plug it in S N equals to one, you get exactly this log dependence. It's that simple kind of. You get this log dependence. Again, it's a little bit with tricks, whatever, but the idea is that at Sn of order one, the mutation and selection balance each other. And then there is an interesting insight which comes to this, again, somewhat simple thing, that at higher mutation rates, you have less stable proteins. And then there is a simulation which allows you sort of to see that. It's, again, a simulation of the population of simple organisms using this model that I used. And there are two types of organisms, one mutating faster and another mutating slower. And you see the faster mutating, the distribution of stabilities, it's 100 genes, each organism has 100 genes. And the distribution of stabilities is shifted to the right. So the highly mutated organisms have less stable proteins, and you can see it from this very sort of simple, but it's polyclonal, obviously, simulation.
What are the colors?
The colors are this is rapidly mutating population, and this is slowly mutating population. And this is the distribution of stabilities in the population of rapidly mutating organisms and slowly mutating organisms. And so they start from very, very high stability, then drift pushes them quickly to more or less equilibrium distribution. And as you can see, the highly mutating are less in average. Again, this is a distribution, but in average, it's shifted towards less stable proteins.
So do you know if there's evidence that like RNA viruses have less stable proteins than DNA ones?
That answers your question. Yeah, indeed. And also, if I have time, but to talk about this viral stuff evolution today, which is highly unlikely I will have, then this fact really plays crucial role in the evolution of this norovirus, which we experimentally studied, because this is really crucial for its escape, that kind of, it's very high mutation rate, it's very, and this is exactly what you're asking about, comparison of sort of proxies for stabilities for RNA and DNA viruses, and that's from this paper.
So which ones are the RNA?
This is DNA viral, which is DNA. This is RNA viral. This is thermophilic organisms, bacteria or archaea, kind of. And this mesophilic, and I think that's it. And eukarya, yeah, mesoeukarya.
And do the thermophilic organisms have higher or have lower mutation rates at all? Like there's more pressure for them.
Exactly. There was a paper by Drake. That's another story which we very much were involved in, and kind of the prediction from this type of games is that for a mesophilic organism, you cannot reach more than 6 mutations per genome per generation, otherwise then it gets kind of completely down. For mesophiles, it's 2. The prediction was, and that's exactly what they found in the Drake kind of. They published a paper where they compared mesophile and thermophile, and mesophiles have lower mutation rates than thermophiles. I mean, higher, mesophiles higher than thermophiles.
Sorry, I have a.
Yeah.
The differences you see here, do they match what you expect from your
quantitative? Well, in principle, the answer is yes and no, because kind of qualitatively yes, but the point is that these are not really stabilities delta G's, because these are various proxies for stability. So what they did, the kind of the number of contacts, the number of hydrogen bonds, and so on and so on, because there are not so many data on stabilities of RNA viral proteins or DNA viral proteins. So, I mean, they make this claim that they are more stable, I mean, less stable RNA and more stable in DNA, but they use kind of not direct measurements of delta G's, but the various kind of ways to predict these delta G's. And if you translate them using the standard thing, that's more or less consistent because it's two orders of magnitude different. Log, it's about 4 or 5 kcal per mole, which roughly would be what the theory predicts. But I won't really claim that that's an agreement because this is really kind of a weird map. Okay, so we're done with theory, and now. Again, these questions like immediately arise, how good all these assumptions, because as I said, I mean, when you kind of cook up these models, you make these assumptions, whether it's good to have more proteins, not good, and so on. And more generally, kind of the relation between, say, fitness and stability, and so on. And the question, as I said, is how good these assumptions are. And there are, in principle, one could try to get this insight into that by doing bioinformatics, sort of analyzing existing sequences this way or another. And there are many experts, including in this room, in doing that in a very, very careful and fairly brilliant way. But still, nevertheless, this is the problem here because kind of what we observe has been already kind of passed through some selection process. And so this is not really kind of if I see some mutation sort of fixed or whatever, or in some multiple sequence alignment, some frequencies, that does not mean that this is exactly corresponding to S's. Kind of like I might try to derive this S's from frequencies, but in fact, you have to have a model to link S to frequencies. And of course, kind of model is a model. And so what kind of in some bout of insanity, what we tried to do is to kind of introduce, kind of to look at it fairly bottom up. So in other words, to determine kind of fitness effects without selection experimentally. And the idea is fairly straightforward, kind of so like what we're trying to do. And this is a fancy slide for that. But basically, kind of the idea is to link this kind of properties in experimental approach, using an experimental approach, is to link these properties to these fitness effects. And these are properties that we're interested in. And specifically, the way how this approach works is at least kind of philosophically, but in practically as well, is that first of all, kind of we choose several proteins. I will talk about two, which we want kind of to explore, in for which we want to explore the link between their sort of biophysics and fitness. And of course, looking at this protein, the protein must be essential so that if you knock it out, the beast does not live. Otherwise, you won't see phenotype. Protein should be relatively simple so that you can do biophysics on it. And of course, it must have structure known so that we can really kind of do some bioinformatics work to determine the set of mutations where which we would like to cover. And that's not necessarily point mutations. As you will see, the key part of the game here is not point mutations, but autologous replacements. But basically, kind of we decide on what kind of genetic change we want to introduce in order to explore. Then kind of we make these changes. Express proteins with these mutations or changes, purify them, and do all this in vitro block of measurements. I will show a couple of examples specifically, like we can measure delta G, it's perfectly measurable quantity. Of course, we can measure catalytic activity, we can measure aggregation propensity, we can measure protein-protein interactions, we can measure various important population of intermediates and folding from spectroscopy. So there is a whole kind of toolbox, biophysical toolbox, to characterize these mutants at the molecular level. Then comes fun because we can make the same mutations on the chromosome using genetic editing and can create strains of like E. coli in this case, and we have also now done almost the same for yeast. And create the bugs which carry exactly the same mutation in their chromosome, and then we can measure their fitness. And then kind of we can link, can ask these questions, which of those are important for fitness, kind of which of those changes are most relevant to predict fitness effects, and have some fun. So now, one thing that I want to mention about measuring fitness, there are several ways how to measure fitness. The simplest one, which is actually quite telling, is that you simply measure growth rate. So this is E. coli. And the thing that I want to mention here, which will be relevant for some discussion, subsequent discussion, is there are two phases when this bacteria start to grow. They start from leg phase. Kind of it takes them a little while, maybe a couple of hours, to acquire various metabolites to start growth. If you change the environment, of course, you add nutrients, etc., so that you set up growth. Then they enter the exponential phase, and the slope, of course, is growth rate, which is the key property. And then they, when they run out of or achieve carrying capacity for this or that reason, run out of nutrients, they enter the stationary phase, and sometimes they can enter the death phase. So kind of in this measurement of fitness, we do sometimes competition experiments between wild type and mutant, but typically kind of for each mutant, we measure both leg and exponential growth and carrying capacity, this parameter up to what it goes. So now kind of what we want to do, we want to project this fitness into these various properties. And as I said, I have a story about each of those and some of this. And so let's start from stability. So the first question is whether this kind of landscapes that I sort of presented out of blue, whether they are right or wrong, whether they are good or bad, like delta-delta G, fitness versus delta-delta G. And so we have two models for that, and the difference will be very, very important. One model is this DHFR. This is dihydrofolate reductase, and this is what is very. There are two important aspects of this DHFR thing. One is that it's a very low copy number enzyme. So I mean, 100 is a little bit an overestimate. Kind of the really more accurate estimates from Sunny Shi's lab. It's about 50 molecules per cell. So each E. coli carries has about 50 of these DHFR molecules per cell. It's very important. And another important aspect of it is that it is part of the metabolic chain, which produces tetrahydrofolate, and tetrahydrofolate is the key source of carbon atoms for several crucial processes, including the synthesis of DGTP, which is a biosynthesis of DNA, and several amino acids like glycine, serine, and this is very will be very important, and methionine also.
So this is going to be the example that more means more fitness.
More means less fitness. You will see more means less fitness. Fitness goes up if you overexpress DHFR.
So kind of the opposite.
The opposite. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's really very, very interesting why it is the case. But it's the opposite to what you would expect. And now this is a more standard enzyme. This is adenylate kinase. And there are two opposite aspects of it. One is that it's highly expressed, about 10,000 copies. And another, it's a standalone enzyme which catalyzes this reaction, which sort of controls the balance between ADP, ATP, AMP. And it's standalone, again, it's important.
Could you turn to your answer to his question? You said more of this protein means less fitness.
Yes.
Then earlier in the talk, you were giving us a general description that the number, that fitness is proportional to the number of folded proteins.
Yes, that was my assumption. Now I'm trying to test this assumption. That was my theoretical assumption, and this is my experimental answer. So I will show, of course, this plot if I have time. But for DHFR, the relation of fitness versus abundance, so how much of this DHFR you make in the cell, you produce in the cell, and this is fitness, and this is log. I will show the actual slide, but just to give you an answer, it behaves like that. So when you overexpress it about 100-fold over normal, it starts to fall.
Is that just the cost of making the protein?
No, absolutely not. So I have the whole story about why this is so, and the answer is, of course, not. Because for ADK, this curve would be like that. I will show the curve for adenylate kinase. This is just flat. As you make them more and more, the cell doesn't care. But if you make more and more DHFR, the cell really becomes completely unhappy about it.
So you don't expect this to be a general bell shape for all proteins?
No, it's mostly, this is mostly an exception. Yeah, no, no, no. I will show again the data because we measured it for many proteins, this shape. And the rule is like that, plateau. And this is an exception. I mean, there are many proteins that behave like that, but still the more proteins behave like that.
Okay. But so going back to your theory, very few actually increase fitness as you increase?
Well, I mean, they are at the plateau.
Yeah.
But for the theory, it doesn't really matter because the theory does not kind of consider the changes of expression. It considers the changes in stability. Because if you have a super stable protein, kind of it will reach the plateau rather than increase the total number of. So for the delta G theory that I present, it's kind of immaterial. But if you include evolution of expression levels, that becomes very important for that. But the theory kind of had a fixed expression level. In the theory, the expression level is fixed. And the only thing that changed this is mutations affected stability. That's why the folded proteins, the number of folded proteins is the total number, which is constant, multiplied by this Boltzmann factor, which is. Therefore, this corresponds to this landscape.
So
yes,
why isn't there a cost to producing an unnecessary protein?
I don't know. But that's the fact. I will show the data, and apparently there is not. You produce about 1,000 times more protein, and it goes like that.
Well, it may depend on the scales. I mean, there may be, for experimental scale, it's certainly flat, but to, like you said, to N E times S, it may actually be selected for.
Yeah, it might. Yeah, I mean, if you believe in 1 over N selection coefficients, et cetera, it might be. No. That is right. Of course, as much as experiment can tell you. But again, this is in contrast because kind of in for DHFR, you perfectly see it by eye. Your experiment shows this loss of. It's about factor of 2. If you overexpress DHFR a factor of 100, the growth rate drops factor of 2. You see it by eye. It's not 10 to the minus 9 selection coefficient. It's something that you see just by eye. You see it just by eye, they simply don't grow.
Very different.
Totally different, yeah. So, of course, it still can be, you're absolutely right, that in population genetics terms, it still can be a little bit of a fitness effect, which we cannot see experimentally. Simply, we don't have accuracy for that. But on the experimental level of resolution, we see flat lines.
How are you counting the proteins?
The amount?
Yeah.
There are several ways. The simplest, of course, is Western blot.
Yeah.
Because we have antibody against all these kind of things. Then there is an assay which the postdoc developed. So basically what you do, you measure kcat over km for each protein. And then you measure the total activity in the lysate. And then you divide the activity in the lysate by kcat over km, and you get a very good estimate of the abundance. Yeah, and the third one is with GFP, which we use. Mm-hmm.
Maybe this is sort of what you're... So I thought before you were emphasizing the number of folded proteins.
Right.
But here you're just looking at the total protein amount, but because it's a wild-type protein that you're overexpressing, you assume that they're all...
Yeah, or we know what fraction is folded, and it's like about maybe at least 90% folded because we know delta G for them.
So the difference
is not big for this.
Okay,
for this.
In the previous ones where you were introducing mutations, now you actually have to calculate...
The folded, yeah, because when we introduce mutations, we grossly destabilize them, and we get a very, very few folded proteins. But in this case, we overexpress wild type, and wild type is fairly stable. So kind of if the fraction of unfolded in the wild type ensemble is 10 to the minus 4, so we are 99.999% correct, or even less than for ADK. So kind of let me start from the simple story of this ADK business. So these are the mutants. Of course, there is absolutely no point following this table, but the idea is that kind of that there is a broad range of mutants selected, some of them which are completely forbidden in multiple sequence alignment, you cannot see them, some of them which are highly conserved, and some of them which are not conserved, and all of them are far from the active site because we want to control for stability but not for activity. Multiple sequence alignment. So now these mutants were made. This is shows where they were made. And then for each of them, we measure stability. And this is the way how you do that. Kind of you, this is differential scanning calorimetry called. This is on the vertical axis is heat capacity, on the horizontal axis temperature. As you can see, they unfold. This is the melting temperature at which they unfold. And if this shifts to the left, that means that it becomes less stable. This is wild type. And most of them are less stable. These curves are shifted to the left. Some of them are as stable, but less cooperative. Some of them are, one of the, or two of them are more stable than wild type. Also, you can measure stability by unfolding it in chemical denaturants. And importantly, that you have to match these numbers with these numbers, because that will prove that your protein unfolds to state. Again, this is an old stuff in biophysics, so people do that. And this is kind of the thermodynamics of these mutants. And also, there are certain probes that allow to determine the aggregation status. And also, importantly, their status, kind of, which will be more important when I talk about DHFR, as sort of not folded, but a liquid-like state, not fully unfolded and floppy, but like a liquid droplet. It will become very important with DHFR. Here it doesn't seem to be very important. And this ANS, this is the probe for this liquid state storage. And also measured all activities. And found that a little bit positive correlation between stability and activity. Now fitness, kind of. Now again, as I said, these mutants were incorporated in E. coli chromosome, and their fitness measured. This is growth rate measured at different temperatures, and we see sort of a cliff-like behavior. So that up to some point, the system does not care. You destabilize it. This is the wild-type protein. You destabilize, nothing happens, and then suddenly it starts to fall off.
What is the error of TM measurements?
Error, it's about roughly the size of the symbol, because you can do these measurements in an extremely accurate way. And for this protein, it's piece of cake, because it's reversible and that doesn't aggregate. So kind of the way how it is done, kind of it's robot measures them kind of 100 times. Each experiment is repeated 100 times just by the robotic thing. So this is about the size of the and also growth rates are very accurately measured, because again it's kind of in parallel. This is the robot measures this, and it's parallel 100 trajectories are measured. And so you can fit this into this Fermi-Dirac form, this E minus delta G, and you get reasonably good fit, which is sort of, on the one hand this is nice, on the other hand is sort of boring. But interesting aspect of it is this one, where we measure not for ADK, where we measure not growth rates, but lag times. And for that, we have also a number of these number of mutants, and we measure them not against stability itself, but what we call catalytic contingency, which is abundance, which we measure using Western blot, multiplied by k-ket over km, for which we measured for each mutant. So this is how much catalytic activity in the cell you have. And as you can see, kind of, and these ones, this data comes from, not from this experiment, but from overexpression of ADK from the plasmid. So we add more ADK, throwing more wild-type ADK, overexpressing it from plasmid, and kind of, as you can see, what is interesting, and we're trying to understand why, that it, for lag time, wild type is sitting just on the cusp of the cliff.
What is my lag time?
Lag time is what kind of, this is the measurement that I showed. When you measure the bacterial growth rate, this is how much it waits before it takes off.
So I thought when I saw that plot that was just like the period where it's near the boundary and of like apoptogen simulation.
What?
It would depend just more on the population size.
You mean lag time?
Yeah.
I don't know, because there is no lag time in population in genetics, because in kind of it you have to fairly.
Well, there is usually, like, if you start with a new mutation that's beneficial, then when there's just like one copy in the population,
yes,
like it, the selection on it is inefficient.
Yeah.
It has to drift to a threshold frequency before it gets selected.
That is certainly true, but this experiment does not concern any mutation.
So that's a different thing.
It's a totally different thing. It's a very simple experiment which people did like for hundreds of 100 years for sure. You simply grow the bacteria in petri dish or whatever, or in liquid culture. And then you measure optical density versus time. And you see that you have to wait a couple of hours as you start growing them. You have to wait a couple of hours before they start to grow. And that's lag time. This is very simple thing. So kind of for some reason, which we do not understand, but I think is interesting, that wild type is on this cusp of the, it's way, way here in terms of growth rates, but it is on the cusp for lag time. So it looks like there is some selection for lag time, but I don't know why. I mean, it's definitely depends on how, on their life cycle or whatever, or maybe depends on how you think about fitness more generally, but that's I think, isn't it?
Sorry, I forgot to count it again. So what was
the color is, this is wild type. These are mutants that we generated, and these are our expressed ADKs. This is experiment where we add more wild type ADK from plasmid, pipette plasmid to the cell.
So can you explain the catalytic contingency?
This is the product of abundance, how much protein you have, folded protein you have, because the Western blot is for folded protein antibodies. Times catalytic activity, kcat over km.
Why you want the product of this?
That's fairly general. That comes from theory of, I mean, the simplest answer is Michaelis-Menten, because in Michaelis-Menten, that's what you would kind of expect as activity of your protein is a product of protein concentration multiplied by kcat over km. But for DHFR, it's not that simple. The DHFR, since it's a part of enzymatic chain. There, it's a little bit trickier, but for this one, it's just Michaelis-Menten.
Even if it's not very good, if you have a lot of protein.
Yes, of course, you can compensate it. Yes, yes. And that's what happens, again, in antibiotic resistance. Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Is there something, do you know what's going on with the outlier point at the top left?
I think I forgot. We looked at that, and I think something interesting, but frankly, I forgot. I'll get back to you with that. I'll ask Bharat. I think there was something peculiar here, yeah, but I forgot what was that.
I don't understand why this supports the idea that the lag time is optimizes. Couldn't you argue, regardless of where the yellow point is?
The point is that kind of if you compare, for example, wild type is somewhere here on this growth rate curves. So I did not show the growth rate curve, but if I plot on the vertical axis not lag time but growth rate, I will have my wild type somewhere in the middle of the pack, which means that there is a lot of way low to lower the concentration or to screw up the protein and still have unchanged kind of growth rate on the plateau. But with lag time, it looks like that, all with the exception of this outlier, immediately as you start to mess with the protein, you start to lose some lag time. That's what I wanted to say, that basically with respect to growth rates, you have kind of a lot of way to go, leeway, kind of you can introduce mutations, destabilize the protein, the fitness would not be affected, up to some further destabilization when you start to feel the cliff with respect to wild type, with respect to growth rate in wild type. But here, kind of the point that I'm trying to make, that as soon, immediately after you start to mess with the protein by mutation, you start to lose in lag time. Because this is at the end of this cusp.
But why it's immediately? Because you only sampled 30 mutations.
Yes.
Out of so many possible mutations.
Right, but randomly. What is the, if, let's assume that it's one half chance to be on the right and on the left. You sample 30 mutations, the chance that I will be on the cusp is one half to the 30.
Well, it depends, of course, on the core ratio and the surface and where mutations are located.
No, but they all collapse into delta G, because now we do not consider delta G distribution, because we consider the actual delta G that I measured. And for that, we don't care whether it's core or surface, because we have the final number, delta G. Delta G, and where it is, I don't care. Kind of, it's important. It simply changes kind of my total thermodynamic stability. It's experimental number, not a prediction. And for that, kind of, again, I think it's interesting, but I don't have a good explanation. Or maybe relevant. I don't know. Just wanted to mention. Now, the story about DHFR is much more convoluted in a sense, because it's a low copy number enzyme, and you will see why it matters, and that's one thing. And another thing is that it is part of the enzymatic chain, because there are many enzymes upstream of DHFR and one enzyme downstream. So basically, kind of, it becomes important. So we did the same trick with these mutations, introducing mutations in DHFR. This is, again, the degree of conservation. Some of them are conserved, some of them are not conserved, and so on, so on. This is the list that's published. This is their biophysics. And now, kind of, we get some sort of funny outcomes. Kind of, we measure, again, fitness at various conditions. And like, for example, if you measure it at 42 degrees, the distribution of this fitness factor, in this case, it's not growth rates, but it was an early measurements where we thought that it's very important to run competition. This is a competition experiment, like Lenski does, kind of, with neutral marking mutant and wild type, and then competing them in liquid culture, and then growing them in colonies, and so on. So this is the ratio of colonies, wild type, and mutant. And like at 42 degrees, when we do that, we see by model distribution, some of them are highly fit, and some of them are completely little. And it turns out that kind of the good question is why these mutants are little. And it turns out that they are not even unfolded, but they form this kind of liquid-like molten globule state. And the way how to determine it, there is, again, a very old essay, which I learned when I was back in Russia many years ago in Ptitsin's lab, where they used it, which is kind of basically the idea is that you have three states of the protein rather than two states, completely unfolded, completely folded, and like liquid-like. It's gas-like, solid-like, crystal-like, and liquid-like. This one, where it is, and indeed it was shown that that's the case. It's not a hypothesis. It's experimentally established for many proteins, where it is sort of folded in terms that it's a compact polymer, but it lacks tertiary structure. So it's like a sort of floppy compact state, like a liquid droplet. And there is an assay which allows to determine the proportion of this liquid-like structure. And the assay is kind of to look at the INS fluorescence, because this is a compound, INS, whose fluorescence is quenched in water. So if they can penetrate this liquid state, then they are not kind of quenched by water. And you see fluorescence going up when this kind of liquid state goes up, but then it again goes down when the protein completely unfolds, because there is nothing to screen it from water. And so this is this ANSSA, which gives you sort of the proportion of proteins in this liquid-like state. And it turns out that this the ones which fail to fold, for them there is a huge amount of this molten globule state. So they seem to be kind of failing to fold properly at least 42 degrees in fully folded state, but they form this kind of liquid-like molten globules. And but the fun comes when you start to play a little bit further with cell biology here, because what Shimon did, again, it was kind of very late Christmas day of 2011, maybe had nothing to do, he's Jewish. And so, just out of desperation, he started to play with the cells. And he transfected this kind of one of this little mutant with the plasmid which overexpresses chaperon, GroEL. And immediately, kind of, the growth completely revived. So basically, when you add this folding machine to them, the cell starts to grow just absolutely normally. So this is kind of this mutant almost doesn't grow, a little bit kind of after long, long time. But then when you overexpress GroEL, you basically get normal wild-type growth. So you add GroEL and it grows just like fun. And but what is interesting, then he started to knock out various proteases, and he found one protease which acts exactly, whose knockout acts exactly like a GroEL overexpression. So he knocked out this one of the non-essential proteases, LON, and again, completely revival of the cell growth. And apparently, kind of the idea, of course, given this data from ANS, that these two things, they fight or compete for molten globule, it kind of either molten globule is captured by Gro-EL and completely refolded back and it's happy, or it's captured by Bylon and completely kind of destroyed and it's unhappy. And it turns out that the quantitative effect on fitness by these two branches is almost kind of identical. You can either express more Gro-EL or the knockout lone protease effect on growth rates will be very highly correlated. And what is interesting, that the same trick absolutely doesn't work for ADK. When you do this kind of overexpress various chaperones on the background of this ADK mutant, which some of them are really bad, like this one, it sometimes makes things even worse. For example, if you overexpress DNA KJ, it makes even worse. I mean, the cell grow even worse. So Gro-EL is highly, highly helpful when you have these DHFR mutants, which again is very obvious why, because you have only 100 molecules, Gro-EL can help. When you have 10,000 molecules, Gro-EL cannot help. And there is not enough Gro-EL to do that. Because the overexpression is only a factor of two, it's not that much. But with ADK, there is absolutely no help from chaperones. So basically, kind of this is a different, two different scenarios for this ADK and for DHFR. And for DHFR, it looks like fitness effects are more determined by their kind of existence in an active cytoplasm where they are subject to degradation, refolding, et cetera, et cetera. And ADK is more like this theoretical model that I presented before, where you get kind of the plateaus, cliffs, et cetera, et cetera. And DHFR is more rich model and interesting. So basically now with DHFR, you can now modify this simple statistical mechanics to take into account more dynamic aspects of their life in the cell, where they are produced. They can convert into this molten globular state. They can be captured by Gro-EL, can be released by Gro-EL. And what is important, and when they are in molten globule state, then they can be captured by lone protease and completely get degraded. So this is a very simple theory, and for many of these parameters, you can get experimental numbers. But the interesting, which again, I'm sure I won't have time to present, but an interesting implication from that, what the theory predicted, that the total amount of folded protein is inversely proportional to the equilibrium constant between molten globule and native state. And this equilibrium constant can be measured experimentally by NS fluorescence. So the prediction is that the amount of folded for a given molecule that you observe in Western blot experiments, that you measure in Western blot, will be inversely proportional to its molecular feature, this kind of the ability to sorb NS. And that's exactly what we see experimentally, and that would be, again, I won't have time to present this stuff, but when you try to predict the antibiotic resistance from molecular properties, that is a crucial part of the story there, because kind of you can predict the abundance of the protein in the cell from its own molecular property, and abundance, of course, is a cellular property. So, and that's kind of we don't need to follow the details, they're relatively simple, but the take-home message is that this is the consequence of this kind of process of degradation, synthesis, and refolding. So if you consider a protein living not just as in a solution, but in an active medium, then you get this type of behavior, because in solution, that would be just a linear, if there was no this active degradation, there would be just a linear dependence. And the experiment shows 1 over x dependence. Okay, so now let me move on, and at least to begin telling you the, if there are no more questions, second story, and this
I
is the
question, uh-huh, yeah. If they are post-translationally modified, yes.
Good question. I don't know what will happen.
I think kinase should be probably.
Yeah, so maybe. I mean, it depends. I mean, if they are modified for tagging, like by protease, et cetera, then it might matter a lot. And I think there is some indirect evidence that that could be the case from this story, which I will show. I don't know what it is, actually, but it could be the case. It could be the case, like some tagging or whatever. Yeah, but it's not here, at least in theory, and we don't see it, at least in these experiments. But in these experiments, we might see them. So now the second story that I wanted to tell is the depend kind of how So far, I was talking about the dependence on stability this way or that way. Then I kind of want to talk about catalytic activity. And the problem with probing catalytic activity is that it's relatively simple to introduce mutations that affect stability in a broad range of variation, even stabilizing mutations. But with catalytic activity, we understand it much, much less than protein folding, and therefore kind of to explore the relation between fitness and catalytic activity in a broad range, your point mutations would not work. We simply cannot control catalytic activity by point mutations. So here comes the trick, and that's what you would expect. I will go back to that later. Here comes the trick, and the trick is not to use point mutations, but to borrow DHFR from other organisms, because kind of nature took care of evolving catalytic activity, and therefore there might be a set of DHFRs with a broad range of catalytic activities. So instead of doing these experiments by introducing point mutations on the chromosome, we did autologous replacements on the chromosome. So basically what we did is a very simple thing. So in kind of cut and paste, removed wild-type DHFR and pasted here the DHFR from another bacterium. And in total, we have 43 of them, 43 strains. And so we have 43 strains with autologously replaced DHFR. And for each of these 43 DHFRs, there were guys who were working 24/7 in the lab. They purified them and again measured all their biophysics. So we have 43 DHFRs with well-defined properties. And now we have 43 strains where this beast is replaced. And this is the distribution of biophysical properties of these 43 DHFRs. This is the stability and this catalytic activity. The point is that about half of them are more catalytically active than E. coli, maybe more than half, actually, more than half. And some of them are really kind of almost tenfold more active. It's KCAT over KM, distribution of KCAT over KM over this. And this is E. coli value, and this is...
This is activity for native
ligands
in the native cell, or it's
It's in vitro. No, it's in vitro. In vitro.
It's in vitro. It's after replacement. After you replaced.
No. It's in vitro. We replace in vivo, but we kind of what we do. We for each of them we purify the DHFR and measure activity in vitro. For exactly the same reaction, dihydrophthalate to tetrahydrophthalate. The standard spectroscopic assay that measures KCAT allows you to measure KCAT and ITC to measure KM. So this is sort of more or less standard stuff. And so these are purified in vitro measurements at 37 degrees. So this is just in vitro in test tube, not in the cytoplasm. Okay, so this is the distribution of activities, stabilities, and this is the distribution of fitnesses, which is, in my view, really striking, because what we do here is that we replace wild-type DHFR with many much better molecules, but as a result, we get much worse fitness.
Can I ask, I forgot, how many different bacteria you... 43.
Mm-hmm.
So how many for this peak mean value?
Yes. I mean, there's more than 43, but some of them are selected from this phylogenetic tree. So what's your question?
Yeah, how many bacteria exhibit this less than E. coli?
So it's 50%, so about 20, 40, yeah, like give or take up. About 20. It's percent. Yeah. So, and then this is...
How many molecules are in the cells of
code? Excellent question. Yeah, that's of course the explanation. Yeah. So we get this type of thing. And now the question is why is it? And one hypothesis. I will answer your question because of course that's the crux of the matter. But the first hypothesis is that this kind of autologous DHFR is toxic to the cell. There is some reason because it is whatever. You introduce some foreign protein, it's toxic. But it's not true because if we now express the same protein from plasmid on the background of chromosomal wild-type DHFR, we see no loss of fitness. So it's not toxic. You get do a direct experiment, and it's not toxic. Now, the reason why they lose fitness is because they don't have enough DHFR activity in the cell. That answers your question, Michael, and then I will show the direct measurements of abundance. Because this experiment shows that if you complement these strains with kind of inject their wild-type DHFR from plasmid, you get normal fitness. Fitness recovers. So the point is that you plug in the foreign DHFR, and it's active as far as its KKT over KM is concerned, is very active, but the cell lacks DHFR function. And of course, the answer is, obviously, the only explanation which is correct, is that for some reason, which we will try to explore, I mean, there are two reasons, actually. One reason is that there is not enough DHFR. So that for some reason it disappears in the cell. So you produce it, and again, we tested it, of course, with RNA, whatever. So it kind of, the expression is okay, expression is normal. So that there is no downregulation of expression, but there is not enough, there is enough mRNA produced, but not enough protein. So you add this foreign protein, you replace it, and there is kind of it expresses it. RNA is produced normally, mRNA, but the amount of protein is not sufficient, as you will see. And so now, kind of in order to see what's going on, we did some evolution. We have this wonderful robot to do that. And basically, kind of this is a neutral propagation for about a month. It's longer, a bit longer. And as you can see, kind of they really improved, many of them. Many of them improved fitness after evolution. So like about 500-600 generation. And especially the ones that really sucked, very low growth rate, they sort of went way up. And now we have a few that are sort of better than E. coli. Still, there is some problems, but not as dramatic as here. So evolution consistently improved growth rates. And this is comparison of post-evolution growth rates for this DHFR, I mean, this replacements. And then as you can see, this kind of always the blue dots are universally to the right of yellow dots, which means that they improved to the great extent. And this is wild type. That's how much wild type improved the growth rate in 600 generation. And this is how many of them, kind of most of them, this one dramatically improved, this one dramatically improved. So the question is, what happened? Why? And the answer is, yeah, so before we go into that, this is kind of more or less the answer to Michael's question, because now this is the fitness landscape mapping everything to everything. So whatever we measured here, charge, sequence identity, RNA stability, folding stability, activity, etc., to fitness pre-evolution and post-evolution. And as you can see, that kind of this dependence, kind of the only statistically significant dependence we observe is on catalytic activity and or the product of abundance of to catalytic activity. And as you can see, this is what exactly you would expect from this theory of enzymatic reaction, which I showed on the first slide, didn't have time, but there was a theory which was published in the 80s, that if you have a chain of enzyme, then the flux through this chain depends on the catalytic activity of a particular enzyme in the Michaelis-Menten form. And this is kind of exactly this Michaelis-Menten form that is reproduced here in these experiments, except that pre-evolution we have a number of really very bad outliers here, which do not fit here. And after evolution, these outliers went more or less to the back. So these outliers sort of went back, improved, very much improved, like this one, like here, this is, and so on.
So did this result, this is on your next slide, were there actually mutations in DHFR?
Yes, that's next slide, obviously. Yeah, that's what, yeah, and the other thing which I want to mention is that this kind of fitness upon transformation depended, at least before the evolution, kind of parabolic way on the charge of the DHFR. And the most kind of worse outliers had either very strong positive charge or quite strong negative charge, but E. coli also has strong negative charge. So now back to Mike's questions, whether it was a mutation in DHFR. So what we did, we obviously to answer this question did whole genome sequencing. Not for all of them, but for this the worst offenders. This one. So about five of them. And the answer is that, and then of course we did qPCR and we sequenced the Foley locus DHFR for all of them, 43. And the answer is that none of them had a mutation in DHFR gene upon evolution.
So the expression level of protein decreased?
Not the expression. In one of them, in one evolution, for each of them we did six evolutionary trajectories for 43. In one evolutionary trajectory, there was a mutation upstream of Foley gene which increased its expression. This is a very known mutation which arises in antibiotic resistance to trimetoprim, kind of which it's upstream, it's tenfold increase in expression. They were found once, this mutation. Other than that, the DHFR gene was completely clean. It was nothing.
For example, total expression level of protein.
Right. Yeah. If I have time, I'll show the proteomic data. We have the proteomic data. So now what we found actually is the following. The only change, genetic change, which was common to all these improved ones and not in wild type, because of course you have to compare it with wild type. You have to sequence wild type. There are mutations which are completely unrelated to anything. So the only the ones which showed up in this transfers but not in the wild type is an IS-186 nucleotide insertions upstream of lone protease. So what basically it did, at least a quick and dirty evolutionary solution, it inactivated lone. Because this is a known insertion which inactivates the downstream expression of lone gene. So basically what we see, and of course we immediately measured the concentration of lone. So essentially after evolution, the amount of lone in the cell goes way down.
And what lone is?
Lone is ATP dependent protease, which sort of is not entirely known what it does, but it's assumed to be part of the quality control system. And kind of in the previous story, lone was kind of attacking the molten global state of DHFR. But this is lone protease, and so basically the reason why there is not, but at least for these strains, I wouldn't say that this is for all strains, but at least for these strains, the reason why there was not enough abundance of DHFR is that it got degraded by lone. Because when we kind of measure abundances post and pre-evolution, then we immediately see that after evolution, this is abundance of DHFR. This is abundance of lone. So lone goes down after evolution. It sort of down-regulates lone. But DHFR goes up. This is the distribution of DHFR abundances in these 43 strains. This blue is post-evolution and this pre-evolution. And as you can see, we have a number of strains where Western blot simply cannot detect any DHFR abundance. Of course, there is some, but simply it's beyond what Western blot can capture. But here we don't see that anymore, and we see that all of them acquired some amount of DHFR abundance. Now, kind of the next thing that was very interesting and which...
Nine minutes.
So which means that the story about the overexpression, I won't have time to discuss, but that's fine. So the last thing which we looked at here, which I think is quite fun, is the proteomics analysis of this whole total high throughput proteomics on the cells, because essentially, and we saw it before, I didn't talk about it, this was published this year, that point mutations not only change the pathway in which the protein participates, but also they hugely change the whole proteome. Thousands of proteins change their abundance after that. And so we wanted to see how it works with this kind of how evolution changes the total proteome. And this is the experiment that does that. This is basically what you do. It's called TMT LC mass spec. And so you have several samples. You label each sample differently with a small molecule label of different molecular weight. Then you kind of triptically digest and fractionate mixed mass spectroscopy. So to make the long story short, I don't have time to discuss the technique. But the point is that this technique allows you to determine kind of how each protein changed its abundance with respect to wild type. Which ones go up, which ones go down, and you have this big table with roughly about half of the proteome. Half of the proteome it cannot, but like 4,000 proteins in E. coli, it's about 2,000 proteins it can detect and determine how each of this little thing changes its abundance. And so we did it with several strains, and what we got is quite kind of interesting. So this plot shows the kind of each point is a protein, it's about 2,000 points, and this is the correlation between relative abundance with respect to wild type when you add the inhibitor of DHFR, trimetoprim, and the kind of when you make this horizontal gene transfer. And as you can see that for these several of them, we see exactly the same total proteome effect upon horizontal transfer as we see when we inhibit DHFR. So basically, this is the same kind of effect where you completely change the metabolic profile in the cell by inhibiting DHFR, and that completely propagates to the whole proteome and changes thousands of proteins. And the effect is very similar to just simply inhibition. But after you evolved DHFR, this similarity completely lost, which means that it recovered DHFR function and the proteome recovered to the normal ones. And this is shows kind of the how different functions and proteins belonging to different pathways, how they changed upon evolution. Red means that they got upregulated, and blue means that they got downregulated. And for example, when we introduce this horizontal gene transfer, the cell completely dies out in terms of motility. It kind of it shuts down all genes which are related to its motility. But when the health is recovered from by evolution, then the motility genes pop up and it starts to move like crazy. So this is several things which you can play with.
So is this SALON knockout? Do you know if it's observed in any groups that had like fairly old horizontal gene transfer in nature?
Yes, that's true. Yes, that's true. I mean, there are several strains which have long knockout. And that's probably related to horizontal gene transfer, because when you knock out LON, you allow to transfer genes, at least as far as this is concerned, much more easily. And indeed, I mean, there are several examples of bacteria which have huge amount of horizontal gene transfer, which do not have LON at all. They don't have LON. It's not knockout, but they simply don't have it. So it's an interesting question which we are exploring this AGT with.
Have you tried to introduce other foreign genes which are not in metabolism and to see whether
No, not yet. I mean, there are some limits we should. No, not yet. No, but would be fun to do. No, that's definitely would be fun to do. So the last thing, I have 5 minutes. I will just simply answer Boris's question to show some data, and I will quit this. So this is kind of the third story, which of course I won't be able to present, is the relation to protein abundance, kind of between fitness and protein abundance. And that's for DHFR. This is the plot that I promised to show. This is the dependence of fitness on DHFR abundance. So here we can downregulate it by placing DHFR under IPTG controllable promoter. And when you downregulate it, you lose fitness, obviously, because you don't have, it's essential enzyme, you don't have DHFR function, you lose fitness. That's obvious. It's log scale. But when you upregulate it by expressing more DHFR from PBAT plasmid and whatever, arabinose controllable, that doesn't matter, you see dramatic loss of fitness as well. So the dependence has an optimum. There is an optimum amount of protein that cell kind of needs, and then it drops down. And kind of if you plot it in normal scale, this branch, you get kind of the drop in fitness versus DHFR abundance here, the fold overexpression of DHFR abundance. Now, kind of exactly what Boris asked, and of course that's the first question. And the answer is that we've made a number of controls, and this is kind of the answer to this question. So we overexpressed adenylate kinase, we overexpressed thyridoxin, we overexpressed RAS, which is not in E. coli protein. And as far as kind of we can measure the growth rates, we don't see the effect. Okay? So there is no burden of, at least in this, I can speak only for experiment, in this range of overexpression levels, in this range of whatnot, we don't see a statistically significant effect for these proteins, and we see absolutely clear statistically significant effect for DHFR. So that it's not general cost of overexpressing the protein. Then maybe it's kind of special protein that aggregates. No, it does not, because you can do this fairly standard GFP fusion assay and you don't see any aggregation. So that in the remaining minute, then another possibility is that you make it's kind of, it doesn't want to be a very act kind of a lot of activity. And people sort of, there were many theoretical papers which talk about metabolic toxicity. If you add more function, you get kind of toxicity, etc. So the way how to test it, there are two ways, and I will quit after I present it because I'm very proud of this particular experiment. One experiment is simply to overexpress an inactive mutant. So make a mutation in the active site of DHFR, and this is activity, and overexpress an inactive mutant, right? And the answer is even more toxic. And the last thing, which is really kind of interesting, is to overexpress this ortology DHFRs from other organisms. And as you can see, some of them are more active, but only when you overexpress wild-type DHFR, you get loss of fitness. When you overexpress DHFRs from other bees, you basically get a little worse, a little better, sometimes considerably worse, but it's not toxic. So you throw kind of foreign DHFR. Now, kind of it's an opposite to what I presented before. Before, kind of you replace DHFR, own DHFR by foreign DHFR on the chromosome. Here, experiment is that it has its own DHFR on the chromosome, wild-type E. coli DHFR, but on the top of it, we add from the plasmid the autologous DHFR. And what we see that only when we throw more wild E. coli DHFR, we get toxicity. If we throw more the stuff that is like 10 times more active, we see no toxicity. Okay? So I'm done. And this is what is going on, but next time.
In the cases, do they still got destroyed?
No. No, it's a lot of them. It's not enough kind of
So instead
proteins.
Of, because in the case you express them alone, they're destroyed. Some
well, I mean, if you express them from the chromosome in a small amount, but here we express them in tens of thousands of copies, they don't get destroyed.
Yeah.
You see them clearly, I mean, if you do Western, you see them, a lot of them, they not get destroyed. And so, I mean, again, that's probably next time, but this is what's going on here. Okay. Thank you.
One last question.
Well, just you covered a lot of territory, and trying to arrive at the take-home message. So going back to this folding and fitness,
right?
I mean, there are many ways in which one can justify this sort of meso-like any saturation effect will produce
right.
these landscape. But the strong statement is that it's really biophysics in origin and temperature enters there, right?
Right.
So then it immediately follows, right, this is universal.
Right.
So it immediately follows that quite generally you expect your distribution of fitness effects
yes.
shift towards larger effects
yes.
at higher temperature.
Yes.
And that should be quite independent of the gene in question.
Yes.
So did you then actually show the evidence that shows this sort of universality of temperature dependence?
Of course, not universality. I mean,
but that's
definitely the case, like in this example that I showed experimentally of ADK and DHFR. DHFR is a bit more complex story, but with ADK, which is a simpler enzyme, it's definitely the case, kind of, because you're from this experiment. It's you can see it by eye how this cliff goes soon and so on. And that's basically kind of, you immediately see that. And for at least for this protein and for 30 mutations, we show that the distribution of fitness effects is shifted to the right as you increase the temperature. And also for DHFR, kind of there, you have to really convert it to fitness the antibiotic resistance things. But you can see that in the evolution of antibiotic resistance for DHFR, if your question is experimental. If your question is theoretical in terms of looking at the data by informatics, I don't know. I mean, it's a good question, absolutely good question, but I don't have the answer to that, just simply analyzing it, like thermophiles, mesophiles, things like that. That could be, but on the other hand, I would say that it's a little bit more tricky because like if you compare, for example, mesophiles to thermophiles, the thermophiles have more stable proteins, which means that epistasis plays a huge role here because basically, they already evolved to be on the plateau, and therefore, though kind of temperature is higher, their stability is greater, and therefore, epistatically, that may not be the case.
I wouldn't necessarily sort of suggest comparing just kind of taking E. coli and looking at distribution of mutations.
At 30, it's 42, for example.
Mutation effects precisely at room temperature and body temperature, and even there you can imagine heat shock proteins are there in order to solve the problem at high temperature.
Right.
And perhaps mocking these adaptive mechanisms out that show that there is for most of the proteins that you look.
Yeah. Yeah, some. Yeah.
Let's say three.
Yeah.
But please, without exceptions.
Yes. two are exceptions.
Yeah,
look at three. Two are
exceptions.
Or even two are exceptions, and one is a rule. Right. Well, I mean, as I said, for both DHFR and ADK, kind of, if you do this, kind of look at fitness effects at high temperature, of course you see this type of effect. And I showed it for ADK, for DHFR is a similar thing. So in a sense, this is 2 out of 2. But again, I mean, as we discussed here, there could be the effect of quality control, chaperoning. On some of them it affects, on some of them it does not. So it could be definitely real biology more complicated than this idealized views. But I think the take-home message is that this very simple kind of landscapes is a good starting point to think about these things, kind of. That I think is supported by what we see. And also, I remember there was a paper by Chris Marks about the distribution of fitness effects at low, at high temperature adaptation, which exactly made this point. This is a PLOS Biology paper, which I can send you the reference, which made exactly this point which you are referring to. So there is some evidence on a more large scale.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.